Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Okay, let's dive in. There are certain names in sports that don't just echo in the record books. They resonate deeply in our collective memory, inspiring a feeling that transcends the game itself. A rare blend of grace, relentless determination, and a global appeal that captures hearts, whether you're a devoted fan or just an occasional observer. And for so many around the world, Roger Federer is absolutely one of them.
Absolutely. He's one of those names. Definitely.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the legend himself, Roger Federer. We've compiled an extensive array of sources, from comprehensive biographies to detailed analyses of his career, providing a truly rich picture of his life, from his childhood in Switzerland to his final emotional bow on the court.
Yep, a massive amount of detail.
We'll cover everything in between. His astounding triumphs, the challenges he overcame, and his unique off-court impact. Our mission today is to distill this massive stack of information into most compelling insights, helping you understand not just what he achieved, but how and why it all truly mattered. We want to give you a shortcut to understanding the essence of Federer's unparalleled journey.
What's truly fascinating here, and what the depth of our sources allows us to do, is trace a complete, almost archetypal arc. We're moving from a young boy, initially prone to fiery outbursts, kicking a football in Switzerland, to becoming this universally adored global icon.
It's quite the transformation.
It really is. We'll connect the dots between those early, sometimes surprising influences and his later, almost unparalleled, success. It's a journey that offers so much more than just sports statistics.
Definitely more than stats.
It's a story of raw talent transforming into mastery, of a young man learning to harness immense natural ability, and crucially, how he maintained that excellence under the most intense global spotlight for decades.
For so long.
For you, the listener, understanding Federer's journey is incredibly valuable because it's a masterclass in dedication, sportsmanship, and the intricate art of navigating a long, high-pressure career with enduring grace. It's about more than just tennis. It's about sustained human excellence and the process of becoming truly great.
That's a powerful framing. So let's begin at the very genesis of this legend by uncovering the foundations of his life and career, tracing his path from a Basel ball boy to a budding professional. What did the sources reveal about those formative years? Perhaps something surprising about his early path?
Well, there's quite a bit, actually.
Roger Federer was born on August 8, 1981, in Basel, Switzerland. His background already had a global dimension from birth, with a Swiss father, Robert, and an Afrikaner, a South African mother, Lynette, which bestowed upon him dual Swiss and South African citizenship.
That dual citizenship is interesting, yeah.
He also has an older sister, Diana. It's interesting how right from the start we see a connection that spans continents, yet he also had a deep grounding in Switzerland, which would become such a huge defining part of his public identity later on.
Absolutely.
It wasn't just a birthplace. It was clearly a profound foundation for his character and his future role as an ambassador for his country.
Indeed, that Swiss identity became truly integral to his public persona and even his professional life. The sources highlight how he didn't just play for Switzerland. He represented it with immense pride.
You really felt that.
He memorably led the Swiss Davis Cup team to their first ever title in 2014, a massive achievement for his nation and a moment of immense national pride.
Huge deal.
And in a more recent, almost symbolic gesture during the COVID-19 pandemic, he volunteered as an unpaid spokesman for Switzerland tourism, starring in advertisements alongside Hollywood celebrities and even South African comedian Trevor Noah.
I remember those ads.
Yeah. This role wasn't just a celebrity endorsement. It underscored how deeply intertwined his global appeal had become with his national identity. There's even a fascinating familial connection, with figures like Swiss prelate Urban Federer and politician Barbara Schmidt-Federer being relatives, further rooting him in Swiss society.
Oh, okay.
It really paints a picture of someone whose identity was not just personal, but deeply national.
It's clear that Switzerland wasn't just where he was from. It was interwoven into the very fabric of who he was and how he represented himself to the world. And his childhood certainly laid a unique groundwork for his career.
It seems so, yeah.
The sources tell us he started playing tennis at the remarkably young age of 3, accompanying his parents, who both worked for Sibagogi Pharmaceuticals, to the company's private courts on weekends.
3 years old. That's incredibly early.
By the age of 6, he was already excelling in his age group. But what truly stands out to me is his incredibly diverse athletic background. He wasn't singularly focused on tennis from day one. He played a multitude of sports, badminton, basketball, football, skiing, swimming, and even soft tennis.
A bit of everything.
He himself credited his exceptional hand-eye coordination to this wide-ranging sports exposure as a child.
This detail raises a crucial question, especially in today's landscape of early athletic specialization. Did his diverse athletic background actually give him a unique, perhaps even crucial, edge in developing such a versatile and fluid game?
It seems likely, doesn't it?
The sources strongly suggest it did. Playing a multitude of sports, particularly something like badminton, would have honed his reflexes, agility, balance, and spatial awareness in ways that solely focusing on tennis might not have.
Makes sense.
It allowed him to build a much more robust and adaptable athletic foundation before he eventually narrowed his focus. This pivotal decision to concentrate solely on tennis came at age 12, and his reasoning is quite telling.
What was it?
He cited feeling more direct control over his victories or defeats in an individual sport compared to the reliance on teammates in team sports like football.
Ah, that control factor.
Exactly. This early realization of personal agency in his outcomes is a deep insight into his developing competitive mindset.
So he wasn't just a natural talent. He was a natural athlete with a broad range of developed physical skills. And this talent was quickly recognized and nurtured.
Yeah, the signs were there early.
At 8 years old, he joined the Old Boys Tennis Club in Basel. His initial instruction came from a veteran Czech coach, Adolf Kakovsky, who immediately described him as a quick learner, someone who could pick up new techniques in just 3 to 4 tries.
3 or 4 tries, that's, wow.
A stark contrast to the weeks it might take others, that's a huge, almost preternatural difference. But the truly pivotal figure in his early development, undoubtedly, was the Australian former player Peter Carter.
Ah, Peter Carter. A crucial name.
Federer began working with Carter at age 10, and Carter rapidly became his long-term mentor and a profound influence.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we see the profound, almost parental impact of these early coaches, particularly Peter Carter, not just on his strokes, but on his overall approach to the game.
Yeah, more than just technique.
It's an insight into the formative years of a true prodigy, revealing how essential mentorship can be. Federer explicitly credited Carter for his entire technique and coolness.
Coolness, I like that.
The sources emphasize that between the ages of 10 and 14, Federer actually spent more time with Carter than with his own family, indicating the extraordinary depth of this mentorship and the trust placed in it.
That's intense.
It was also during this crucial period that his iconic one-handed backhand was cultivated. Kakovsky had a preference for it, and it aligned with Federer's childhood idols, players like Stefan Edberg, Boris Becker, and Pete Sampras, who all famously used it.
Right, all the greats back then.
Providing both direct instruction and powerful aspirational models. This blend of personalized coaching and influential role models clearly set the stage for his unique playing style.
That's incredible, a coach literally shaving his entire technique and coolness. But the road to professionalism, as the sources reveal, wasn't smooth or without significant personal challenge.
No, it definitely wasn't all easy.
At the age of 14, he was invited to the Swiss National Tennis Center in Écublens, a French-speaking region, a significant step away from his German-speaking home in Basel. This period proved quite challenging.
Mm-hmm. A big adjustment.
He struggled with French, found living away from home difficult, and faced the demanding balance of education with intensive training. He even experienced mild bullying, feeling singled out as Swiss-German by many of his peers, and was often on the verge of packing his bags and returning home.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that tough.
Yet, the sources universally credit this difficult and isolating period for forging his fiercely independent spirit and mental resilience.
This definitely raises an important question about character development and the crucible of early adversity. We often think of Federer as this composed, elegant, almost serene figure. But the sources paint a very different picture of his early self.
Oh, really? How so?
It certainly wasn't Swiss maestro from day one. He was initially described as lacking self-control as a junior, an angry person, even a hothead, frequently throwing rackets and causing his parents considerable embarrassment and shame.
No way, Federer, a hothead.
Yeah. One source even noted that rarely a day went by when he wouldn't throw his racket against the fence in his passionate, sometimes volatile, search for the perfect game.
That's hard to picture.
This challenging period at Écublens, combined with his early struggles with temperament, undoubtedly contributed to the mental fortitude and emotional control he would later become famous for. The insight here is how that raw, almost explosive passion wasn't suppressed, but channeled.
Ah, channeled, not extinguished.
Exactly. It matured into the intense focus and almost serene composure we associate with the Swiss maestro, proving that even raw aggression can be refined into grace. He learned to temper these emotions, though the sheer work ethic required to be a consistent professional still took time to fully develop.
Right.
It's a remarkable transformation story within his own early life.
That's a truly profound insight. To imagine the composed Federer we know today as a hothead throwing rackets is genuinely surprising. From those fiery junior years, he quickly began to accumulate significant junior accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. The results started coming.
He won the U12 and U14 Swiss National Junior Championships, marking him as a prodigious talent in his home country. His main accomplishments as a junior player on the international stage came at Wimbledon in 1998, where he clinched both the boys' singles and boys' doubles titles.
Winning both at Wimbledon. Huge.
He then reached the U.S. Open Junior Final later that year, which was, remarkably, his only final loss on the junior circuit. He ended 1998 as the number one junior world ranking and was deservedly named ITF Junior World Champion.
His junior career wrapped up in a way that clearly signaled future greatness, a natural progression towards the professional ranks. He made his ATP debut in July 1998, still shy of his 17th birthday, at the Swiss Open Gstaad, but lost in the first round.
Oh, tough start.
However, later that year, he secured his first ATP match win in Toulouse and received a wild card to his hometown Swiss indoors event, where he notably lost in the first round to the legendary former world number one Andre Agassi.
Running Agassi that early, wow.
Yeah. And here's a fantastic full circle anecdote from the sources. He had actually been a ball boy at that very Swiss indoors tournament in 1992 and 1993, even receiving a medal from champion Michael Stich.
That's brilliant.
This deep dive into the sources shows us a beautiful narrative arc that connects his early childhood dreams and experiences directly to his eventual professional aspirations and encounters with legends.
Right, from being a ball boy idolizing a champion to actually playing against a legend in his hometown tournament. And his rise through the professional ranks was remarkably rapid.
Very quick, yeah.
By September 1999, he officially entered the top 100 at just 18 years and 4 months old, making him the youngest year-ending world top 100 player. He even secured his first professional title on the Challenger Tour, a doubles title on his 18th birthday.
Pretty impressive milestones for a teenager.
This takes us squarely into his early professional years and the start of his ascent to global dominance, a period marked by significant milestones.
Yeah, the next chapter begins.
Moving into the 2000s, Federer's early professional years were marked by a series of increasingly significant milestones that foreshadowed his future dominance. One of his first Grand Slam main draw wins came at the Australian Open against the seasoned former world number two, Michael Chang.
Beating Chang, that's a solid win early on.
He reached his first singles final at the Marseille Open in February 2000, though he narrowly lost to his fellow Swiss compatriot, Mark Rosset. That pivotal year also saw him make his Olympic debut in Sydney, surprisingly reaching the semifinals before losing the bronze medal match.
Olympics so early, too.
A truly important, though often overlooked, step in his early career was winning the Hopman Cup in 2001, representing Switzerland alongside the then world number one Martina Hingis.
Ah, yes, with Hingis.
Federer himself later stated that his experience with Hingis, playing alongside such an established champion, definitely helped me to become the player I am today. It speaks to his willingness to learn from peers and idols.
That Hopman Cup experience with Hingis is indeed a crucial detail, showcasing how external influences and learning from established champions played a significant role in his developmental trajectory.
Yes, soaking it all in.
He then secured his first singles title at the 2001 Milan Indoor Tournament. However, his international breakthrough truly arrived at Wimbledon in 2001.
Ah, the Sampras match?
Exactly. A then 19-year-old Federer famously faced the four-time defending champion, the legendary Pete Sampras, in a highly anticipated fourth-round clash. He defeated the American icon in a thrilling five-set match, dramatically snapping Sampras's incredible 31-match winning streak at Wimbledon.
That was a huge shock at the time, wasn't it?
Massive. This victory was a clear, emphatic statement of his arrival on the world stage, even though he subsequently lost in the quarterfinals to Tim Henman.
Right, Henman got him after.
He continued to build on this momentum, reaching his first Masters final in Miami in 2002, where he lost to Andre Agassi, but then winning his first Masters title in Hamburg later that year, an achievement that propelled him into the top 10 for the very first time.
So the progress was really tangible then.
Definitely stepping up level by level.
But amidst this rising success, he experienced a profound personal tragedy that, as the sources reveal, had a deep and lasting impact on him.
Mm-hmm.
A really difficult time.
In August 2002, his longtime Australian coach and mentor, Peter Carter, died tragically in a car crash.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to five times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
In South Africa. The sources describe his reaction as utterly devastating. He was never so upset in his life, and an Australian newspaper reported that he ran through the streets, bawling and hysterical.
Just awful. You can't imagine.
He himself reflected on the incident, stating that any defeat in tennis is nothing compared to such a moment, underscoring the depth of his grief.
This tragic event, while incredibly painful, became a wake-up call for him, transforming his grief into a renewed and even more focused determination.
A turning point in a tragic way.
His resolve was visibly strengthened after Carter's death, and he famously dedicated his first major win, Wimbledon, in 2003, to his late coach, often pointing skyward in tribute.
I remember that gesture. It highlights how profoundly personal loss can fuel an athlete's drive, transforming sorrow into an even deeper commitment to their craft and to honoring those who shaped them. He finished 2002 ranked as world number 6, laying a solid, if emotionally heavy, groundwork for the era of dominance that was about to unfold.
And what came next was the Grand Slam breakthrough that cemented his arrival. In 2003, Federer won his first Grand Slam singles title at Wimbledon, beating Mark Philippoussis in the final.
Finally, the big one.
This victory immediately placed him in an exclusive club of players alongside legends like Bjorn Borg and Stefan Edberg as one of the few to win both the junior and senior Wimbledon titles. It was a powerful symbolic passing of the torch.
Joining that elite company straight away.
He finished 2003 as world number 2, narrowly behind Andy Roddick, poised for even greater heights.
Then came 2004, the year his sustained dominance truly began to solidify, and the world saw a level of consistency rarely witnessed. Federer won an astounding 3 Grand Slam singles titles that season, the Australian Open, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open.
3 in 1 year.
Becoming the first man to achieve this incredible feat in a single season since Mats Wilander in 1988. Winning the Australian Open also saw him ascend to world number 1 for the first time, a ranking he would hold for an astonishing and then record 237 consecutive weeks.
Just incredible, number 1, and stayed there.
His performance that year was nothing short of remarkable, with 11 singles titles and a stunning 74-6 record, a winning percentage not seen since the likes of Ivan Lendl in 1986.
Those numbers are hard to grasp.
However, even in a year of such overwhelming dominance, there was a surprising stumble at the Athens Olympics, where he lost in the second round to an 18-year-old Tomáš Berdych, a rare moment of vulnerability that reminds us of the unpredictable nature of sport.
Right, even the best can have an off day.
Mm.
That's a staggering level of success and consistency for a single year. And he didn't just maintain it, he actually consolidated it and elevated it further. The period from 2005 to 2007 saw him truly hit his peak, showcasing an almost unbelievable level of sustained excellence.
Yeah, the peak years.
In 2005, he secured 11 titles with an 81-4 record, a 95.2% winning percentage that still stands as the third best in the Open era.
95%. Almost unbeatable.
He won Wimbledon for a third consecutive time and the U.S. Open, famously defeating the iconic Andre Agassi in his last major final. He also played Rafael Nadal in their very first final, the Monte Carlo Masters, a match where Federer showed his fighting spirit by recovering from two sets down, even though he eventually lost.
The start of that rivalry.
Exactly.
This period from 2004 to 2007, you're absolutely right, reveals a player truly at the absolute peak of his powers. What's truly fascinating here is the sheer unwavering consistency, reaching almost every final he entered and those consecutive Grand Slam years.
It's mind-boggling.
Shows a level of sustained excellence that is incredibly rare and difficult to fathom. The 2006 season was statistically his career best. He won a staggering 12 singles titles, the most since John McEnroe in 1984, and amassed an incredible 92-5 match record.
92-5.
Wow. He reached the finals in an astounding 16 of the 17 tournaments he entered. He reached all four Grand Slam finals, winning three and losing only the French Open to Nadal, which was their very first meeting in a major final. He then famously avenged that loss by beating Nadal in the Wimbledon final.
Turning the tables quickly.
In 2007, he again reached all four Grand Slam finals, winning three. He won the Australian Open without dropping a set, becoming the first man since Bjorn Borg in 1980 to do so, an unbelievable feat.
Not dropping a set, that's dominance.
He also famously ended Nadal's open-era record 81-match winning streak on clay at the Hamburg Masters. And at Wimbledon that year, he defeated Nadal for a second consecutive year in a thrilling five-setter, a match many hailed as one of the greatest Wimbledon finals ever, and he equaled Bjorn Borg's record of five consecutive Wimbledon championships.
That final was legendary.
His commanding, almost omniscient presence even earned him the nickname Darth Federer at the 2007 U.S. Open due to his all-black attire and the Imperial March music that playfully played when he was announced on court.
Darth Federer, I remember that.
It was a truly intimidating and glorious era.
A truly dominant era by any measure. But 2008 brought its own significant challenges and revealed a different side of Federer. He was severely hampered by a lingering bout of mononucleosis during the first half of the year, which subtly but effectively undermined his physical capabilities.
The mono year. That explained a lot.
This led to his loss in the Australian Open semifinal, ending his astonishing record of 10 consecutive Grand Slam finals. He also lost twice in Masters finals on clay to Nadal and was famously defeated by Nadal in both the French Open and Wimbledon final.
Those losses to Nadal were tough ones.
The 2008 Wimbledon final in particular, a titanic struggle against Nadal, is still regarded by many as the single best match in tennis history, a testament to the level both players reached.
It was undeniably a challenging year individually, but also a pivotal one for other reasons, signaling a shift in the hierarchy of the sport.
Right, things started to change.
Despite the personal setbacks, Federer found success in team play. He and Stan Wawrinka won the Olympic doubles gold medal in Beijing, notably beating the formidable Bryan brothers in the semifinals.
That Olympic gold was huge for him in Switzerland.
He also captured his only Grand Slam of 2008 at the U.S. Open, defeating Andy Murray in the final, proving his resilience. However, this was also the year he finally lost his number one ranking to Nadal after an unprecedented 237 consecutive weeks at the top.
End of an era, in a way.
This period truly marks the undeniable emergence of the Big Three narrative, with Nadal and Djokovic starting to consistently challenge Federer's long-held dominance, ushering in a new, intensely competitive era.
That's a crucial point, the emergence of the Big Three. Building on that challenging 2008, the sources show 2009 became a monumental turning point. It's almost like a storybook comeback, wasn't it, to finally conquer Roland Garros and then immediately break Sampras's major record at Wimbledon.
Yeah, 2009 was massive for his legacy.
He started 2009 with a loss to Nadal in a fiercely contested Australian Open final, a match that pushed both men to their limits. But his season truly turned around at the Madrid Masters, where he delivered a significant victory, defeating Nadal on clay for only the second time in their rivalry.
Beating Rafa on clay was always a big statement.
Then, after Nadal's unexpected defeat to Robin Söderling at the French Open, Federer suddenly became the undeniable favorite. He fought through incredibly tough five-set matches against Tommy Haas and Juan Martín Del Potro before finally defeating Söderling in straight sets to capture the Coupe des Mousquetaires.
The one he'd been chasing for so long.
And, with it, complete the elusive career Grand Slam tying Pete Sampras's record of 14 major titles.
That French Open title was indeed monumental, the culmination of years of relentless effort and near misses on the Parisian clay.
And he didn't stop there?
No, he didn't. At Wimbledon that very same year, he faced his longtime rival, Andy Roddick, in a final that became historic for being the longest Grand Slam final in terms of games played. Federer ultimately prevailed 16-14 in a record-setting fifth set.
16-14, unbelievable finish.
Winning his 15th Grand Slam singles title and, in doing so, breaking Sampras' all-time record.
Mm-hmm.
Later that year, the U.S. Open semifinals against Novak Djokovic, he hit what many still consider to be the greatest shot of his career. A spectacular tweener winner.
Oh, that tweener, iconic.
An audacious shot played between his legs to set up match points. Although he ultimately lost that final to Del Potro, 2009 was a year of immense defining achievement that solidified his place at the very top of the sport.
Absolutely defining.
He finished the season as the year-end number one for the fifth time in his career, truly a testament to his resilience and capacity for reinvention.
Absolutely. It was a year that truly redefined what was possible for him personally and for the sport. And that immense period of dominance transitioned into an era of sustained excellence and iconic rivalries throughout the 2010s, where he continued to challenge and reinvent himself.
Mm-hmm. The next decade brought new challenges.
Entering the 2010s, Roger Federer continued to demonstrate remarkable consistency, even as the competitive landscape of men's tennis became increasingly challenging. In 2010, he kicked off the year by winning the Australian Open, defeating Andy Murray in the final.
Starting strong again.
This marked his 16th major title, bringing him level with Andre Agassi's record of 4 Australian Open titles. It also concluded an extraordinary run where he had appeared in 18 out of 19 Grand Slam finals since Wimbledon 2005.
That stat, 18 out of 19 finals, is just ridiculous.
While this tournament marked the statistical end of his absolute unchallenged dominance at the majors, he was far from finished. He lost his number one ranking that year, but towards the middle of July, in a strategic move, he brought on Pete Sampras's old coach, Paul Annacone, on a trial basis to help refine his game.
Bringing in Annacone was an interesting move.
He ended the year on a high, winning the ATP Finals in London, notably beating all fellow members of the Big Four in that tournament, a statement that he was still very much a force.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this period shows Federer's incredible resilience. Even as Nadal and Djokovic reached their primes, he was still adding major titles and breaking records, redefining longevity at the top.
He just kept adapting.
2011, by his own incredibly high standards, was considered a lean year with no Grand Slam titles. However, he did make a significant impact at the French Open semifinals, where he delivered a crucial victory, ending Novak Djokovic's remarkable 43-match unbeaten streak with a 4-set win.
Stopping that Djokovic streak was huge.
Though he then lost the final to Rafael Nadal. He also experienced some tough character-building losses that year, losing 2 Grand Slam matches after winning the first 2 sets against Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the Wimbledon quarterfinals and against Djokovic in the U.S. Open semifinals, where he famously held 2 match points.
Oof, those 2-set leads lost must have stung.
These close, heartbreaking losses highlight the increasing pressure and the rising challenge from his formidable rivals, forcing him to adapt. Despite this, he finished the season strong by winning his last 3 indoor tournaments, including the ATP Finals, ending the year ranked number 3.
He certainly bounced back in 2012, demonstrating his enduring class and ability to return to the very summit of the sport. He won Wimbledon for the 7th time, dramatically tying Pete Sampras's open-era record.
Tying Sampras at Wimbledon, magical moment.
With this victory, he also returned to the world number 1 spot, breaking Sampras's record of 286 weeks at the top of the rankings. It was a remarkable achievement, especially at 30 years old, when many thought his best years were behind him.
Back to number 1, proving people wrong again.
He also won an Olympic silver medal in singles at the London Games after an epic 4-hour, 26-minute semifinal against Juan Martín Del Potro, though he then lost the final to Andy Murray.
That semifinal against Delpo was exhausting just to watch.
By the end of that year, he confirmed his 300th week at number 1, becoming the first player in history to reach that significant milestone. This was a testament to his sustained excellence and his capacity to regain lost ground.
This era wasn't without its significant physical toll, however, a reminder that even legends are human. 2013 proved to be a particularly challenging year as Federer developed persistent back injuries, causing his ranking to drop from number 2 to number 6.
Ah, the back problems started cropping up more.
He suffered his worst Grand Slam defeat since 2003, losing in the second round of Wimbledon, which abruptly ended his incredible record streak of 36 consecutive Grand Slam quarterfinal appearances.
That streak ending felt like a big moment.
This raises an important question for all athletes. How do legends, even though seemingly invulnerable, navigate these periods of physical decline, the creeping doubts, and the very public scrutiny? He also strategically parted ways with Paul Anacone that year, actively seeking a new direction and a different perspective to revitalize his game.
Always looking for an edge, even in tough times.
It showed a proactive willingness to adapt and change when faced with significant adversity, rather than stubbornly clinging to what was no longer working.
Exactly. And adapt he certainly did, showing a profound understanding of self-improvement. In late 2013, he brought on the legendary Stefan Edberg as co-coach. And then in 2014, he made a crucial and long overdue equipment change.
That the bigger racket, finally.
Switching from a long-standing 90-inch racket to a larger, more powerful 97-inch racket. For years, he'd been at a comparative disadvantage in equipment, as many of his top rivals used larger, more powerful frames. This change was a clear sign of his constant evolution in the face of new challenges.
Yeah, a necessary change.
The willingness to tinker, even with the fundamentals of his game. The 2014 season also brought him immense team success and national pride, as he led Switzerland to their first ever Davis Cup title alongside Stan Wawrinka, a win that broke attendance records and captured the nation's imagination.
That Davis Cup win meant so much to him.
He reached the Wimbledon final that year, losing to Djokovic in another epic five-set match. And even though he had to withdraw from the ATP Finals due to another back injury, he finished the year with significant achievements, demonstrating his ability to still compete at the very top.
In 2015, he achieved his 1,000th career win, becoming only the third man in the Open era to reach that astounding milestone.
1,000 wins, just incredible longevity.
And a testament to his sheer longevity, winning at least one title in 15 consecutive years. He secured a record 8th Jerry Weber Open title, further cementing his dominance on grass. He reached both the Wimbledon and U.S. Open finals again, ultimately losing both to Novak Djokovic, who was arguably in his physical prime during this period.
Running into peak Djokovic was tough for everyone.
This highlights his enduring presence at the very pinnacle of the sport, even as his rivals were reaching their own incredible heights. It was a period defined by consistent finals appearances, proving his game was still elite, despite the mounting pressure from formidable younger opponents who are also making their own history.
It's truly fascinating how he consistently kept pushing the boundaries of his game and evolving. Let's delve into that a bit more. His signature playing style and the significant innovations he brought to the court.
Yeah, his game was always a work of art.
When you watch Federer play, it's not just effective. It's often described as poetry in motion, a masterclass in grace. But the sources reveal it's not just natural talent or raw aesthetics, it's a constant refinement of technique, daring innovations like the SABR, and even a willingness to adapt his fundamental equipment.
Absolutely. Federer was widely described as the quintessential elite, all-court, all-around player, renowned for his exceptional speed, incredibly fluid style, and unparalleled shot-making.
He could do everything.
While he predominantly played from the baseline, he was equally comfortable, and indeed lethal, at the net, widely considered one of the best volleyers in the game. He possessed a powerful, accurate smash, and was famous for his versatile backhand smash, the delicate skyhook, the decisive half volley, and the athletic jump smash.
That variety was key.
David Foster Wallace, in his iconic essay, famously compared the controlled, brutal force of Federer's forehand motion to that of a great liquid whip, while John McEnroe simply, and perhaps most accurately, called it the greatest shot in our sport.
I praise for McEnroe.
It was a weapon of both power and pinpoint accuracy.
And his one-handed backhand, which we discussed earlier as being cultivated in his junior years, was, as the sources highlight, truly a thing of beauty, offering immense variety.
Of that backhand.
He could employ a biting slice to lure opponents to the net, hit powerful topspin winners that whipped past them, and even a unique flick backhand, generating incredible pace and angle with just a snap of his wrist, often used for devastating passing shots.
So many options off that wing.
His serve was also incredibly effective, a silent assassin. He averaged an astounding 90% of service games won throughout his career, often delivering critical, unreturnable serves on key points.
90% service games won is just nuts.
It was notoriously difficult for opponents to read because he used a strikingly similar ball toss, regardless of the serve type or intended direction, which allowed him to consistently hit speeds around 200 kilometers and capable of reaching a blistering 220 kilometers.
That disguise was crucial.
It was a masterclass in deception and power.
Beyond his fundamental strokes, which were already legendary, Federer consistently innovated, always seeking an edge. Later in his career, he seamlessly incorporated the drop shot into his arsenal, executing it with remarkable disguise off both wings, adding another layer of unpredictability to his game.
The drop shot became such a weapon for him later.
He's also famously known for the spectacular tweener, the between-the-leg shot, most notably hitting a winner against Novak Djokovic in the 2009 U.S. Open semifinals to set up match points, a moment that showcased both his audacity and his incredible talent.
Pure magic, that shot.
But perhaps his most daring and talked-about innovation was the SABR, or sneak attack by Roger, where he would aggressively charge the net on an opponent's second serve, hitting the return almost on the service line.
The SABR, that was wild when he started doing that.
This incredibly aggressive tactic, credited to his coach Severin Luthi, caught many opponents completely off guard and show his willingness to disrupt conventional play.
And let's not forget the strategic racket change in 2014 when he moved from his long-favored 90-square-inch frame to a larger 97-square-inch one.
Yeah, the equipment evolution.
While this provided him with easier serving and improved defense, allowing him to contend with the power game of his rivals, it also, as the sources noted, led to some diminished control and power on his forehand, slice backhand, and drop shot.
A trade-off, for sure.
It was a conscious trade-off, but one that allowed him to evolve his game, especially after Stefan Edberg joined his coaching team, pushing him to play an even more offensive style, attacking the net more frequently and significantly improving his volleys.
Edberg's influence was clear there.
His willingness to constantly adapt and strategically reinvent his game, even at the peak of his career and when already considered a legend, truly set him apart and allowed for incredible longevity.
That adaptability is maybe his greatest strength.
That deep well of adaptability would be tested even further, bringing us to a period that many consider his true renaissance. His extraordinary comeback from debilitating injuries in the mid-2010s, his final years, and his incredibly emotional retirement.
Yeah, the final act was something else.
The year 2016 was, by all accounts, a dramatic low point, one that challenged the very notion of Federer's career longevity. He sustained a significant knee injury, requiring arthroscopic surgery in February, which forced him to miss several major tournaments, including Monte Carlo, Dubai, Indian Wells, and Miami.
That knee injury felt serious from the start.
He then made the unprecedented decision to withdraw from the French Open, ending an incredible record run of 65 consecutive Grand Slam main draw appearances, a streak that felt almost unbreakable.
Missing Roland Garros after all those years.
Wow. The knee re-injured at Wimbledon, where he lost in the semifinals, ultimately forced him to miss the Olympics and the entire remainder of the 2016 season. It was his first season since 2000 without a single title, and his ranking plummeted to number 17.
Looked like it might be the end, didn't it?
At 35 years old, many analysts and fans genuinely believed his outstanding career was finally definitively coming to an end.
This period, as the sources make clear, truly raises an important question that speaks volumes about his dedication and mental fortitude. How many athletes at age 35, staring at such a significant injury, a long hiatus from competition, and a plummeting ranking, would even attempt to come back, let alone one of this magnitude?
Most would probably call it quits.
His return in 2017 was nothing short of remarkable, defying all expectations. Despite his ranking having slipped to number 17 at the start of the season, he made a sensational comeback at the Australian Open, defeating three top 10 players and ultimately overcoming his great rival, Rafael Nadal, in a thrilling five-set final.
That 2017 Australian Open final was epic.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable.
This wasn't just his first major title since 2012. It was his first ever Grand Slam victory over Nadal outside of the grass courts. And it made him the oldest man to compete in a Grand Slam semifinal since Jimmy Connors in 1991.
Turning back the clock.
He then continued this astonishing run, winning his 90th career title at Indian Wells in Miami, completing the coveted Sunshine Double, and dramatically re-entering the top 10. It was a true sporting miracle.
And the strategic brilliance of his approach became even clearer. He then made a calculated decision to skip the entire clay court season to manage his longevity and physical health.
Smart move, focusing on his strengths.
And it paid off spectacularly. He returned on grass, winning a record-extending 9th title at the Jerry Webber Open without dropping a single set. This was immediately followed by his record-breaking 8th Wimbledon title, his 19th major overall, achieved again without dropping a single set.
8th Wimbledon without dropping a set. Staggering.
This made him the oldest male player to win Wimbledon in the Open era, and only the second man in the Open era, after Bjorn Borg in 1976, to win Wimbledon without dropping a set. That's simply incredible, a testament to not just talent, but intelligent career management.
And 2017 was also notable for his significant role in the creation and inaugural participation of the Laver Cup, a team competition he himself founded, designed to celebrate the sport and its legends.
Ah, yes, the Laver Cup, his baby.
He not only won both his singles matches in the competition, but, in a truly iconic moment, played doubles with his longtime rival and friend Rafael Nadal for the very first time, securing the cup for Team Europe.
Seeing him and Rafa on the same side was amazing.
He was widely regarded as the most accomplished player of the inaugural tournament. He continued his winning ways by capturing his 94th career title at the Shanghai Masters, surpassing Ivan Lendl, and then his 8th Swiss indoors title in Basel. His 2017 season was statistically his best since 2007, a truly astonishing renaissance that few thought possible.
He carried that almost unbelievable momentum into 2018. He successfully defended his Australian Open title, achieving his 6th AO title and a monumental 20th major singles title.
Number 20. A huge milestone.
Becoming the first man in history to reach that milestone. Shortly after, he became the oldest ATP world number one at 36 years and 195 days old, breaking a record that had stood for years.
Oldest number one ever. Incredible.
He started the season with a career best 17-0 record, showcasing a sustained level of play that defied his age. However, despite the strong start, he again strategically skipped the clay season and later lost his number one ranking for the final time in Halle.
Couldn't hold on to number one forever.
He suffered a surprising and deeply frustrating loss in the Wimbledon quarterfinals, despite being two sets up and holding a match point against Kevin Anderson, indicating that even with the renaissance, the physical and competitive challenges were persistent and unforgiving.
That Anderson loss was a tough one to watch. Sure, the margins were getting finer. The final years of his career, as the sources meticulously document, were marked by a valiant and increasingly difficult effort to continue competing at the highest level, despite recurring injuries and the relentless march of time.
Yeah, the injuries really started to mount.
In 2019, he retained the Hopman Cup with Belinda Bencic, and for the first time since 2016, played the clay court season, securing his 1,200th career win. He won his 100th career singles title in Dubai, becoming only the second man after Jimmy Connors to reach that three-figure mark.
100 titles. Another massive number.
He reached a record 12th Wimbledon final that year, facing Novak Djokovic in the longest Wimbledon final in history. A grueling 4 hours and 57 minutes, where he famously held 2 championship points, but ultimately lost in a final set tiebreak.
Oh, that 2019 Wimbledon final championship points. Brutal.
Absolutely heartbreaking for his fans.
The recurring knee injuries then became a dominant and heartbreaking theme from 2020 onwards, ultimately dictating the pace of his farewell. He underwent 2 arthroscopic procedures on his right knee in February and June 2020, causing him to miss much of that season and 2021.
Multiple surgeries, that's tough.
This meant 2020 was only the second year in his entire career since his first title that he finished without a win. In March 2021, Novak Djokovic surpassed his record for most weeks as ATP number one, a significant milestone that signaled a change in guard.
The record started falling to Novak.
Federer made a brief return but withdrew from the French Open due to continued knee problems and suffered a straight sets loss in the Wimbledon quarterfinals to Hubert Hurkacz, his first straight sets loss at Wimbledon in 19 years and only the second time he lost a 6-0 set in the 21st century.
That loss to Hurkacz, especially the bagel set, felt like the end was near.
It really did. He then underwent yet another more invasive knee surgery in August 2021.
This period, while undeniably marked by increasing injury and the natural fading of a legendary career, truly highlights the profound human element of his journey. Despite immense public pressure and the escalating physical challenges, he orchestrated a stunning comeback and then managed his eventual exit with immense grace and an emotional impact that transcended the sport.
Absolutely.
Especially that final doubles match with Nadal. By 2022, he dropped out of the top 50 for the first time in decades. And then, for the first time since his professional debut, became unranked.
Seeing him unranked was just strange.
On September 15, 2022, he announced his impending retirement from professional tennis, with the Laver Cup being his final ATP event. He clarified he would play more tennis in the future, of course, but just not in Grand Slams or on the tour.
The retirement announcement hit hard.
His final professional match was a doubles loss, alongside his longtime rival and friend, Rafael Nadal, against Jack Sock and Francis Tiafoe, his 1750th tour match. The enduring image of him and Nadal, two titans of the sport, sitting side by side, holding hands, and openly crying together during his farewell, is one that will forever be etched in sports history.
That image, unforgettable.
Symbolizing a rivalry that became an enduring friendship.
A truly emotional and fitting end to an unparalleled career, demonstrating that even legends are human and feel profound emotion. But Roger Federer's story is far more than just his individual journey. It's about the phenomenon he created through his defining rivalries, his truly staggering records, and his immense pervasive off-court impact.
Yeah, the legacy is huge.
Let's talk about the defining rivalries first. Federer wasn't just a dominant individual. He was a leading figure in men's tennis alongside Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic, collectively known as the Big Three.
The Big Three are absolutely legendary.
These rivalries weren't just contests of skill. They pushed each man to unprecedented heights, and in doing so, they collectively elevated the sport itself to a golden era.
What's fascinating here is that while Federer's individual dominance was immense, his era is truly defined by these epic rivalries. They pushed each other to unprecedented heights, creating some of the most memorable matches in tennis history, becoming narratives that captivated millions worldwide.
Absolutely.
His rivalry with Rafael Nadal, for example, spanned 40 matches, with Nadal holding a 24-16 lead overall. They contested 24 finals, including a record 9 major finals.
9 major finals against each other.
Nadal, predictably, dominated on clay with a 14-2 record, while Federer notably had the edge on grass 3-1 and hard courts. 11-9. They famously held the top two rankings for significant periods from July 2005 to August 2009 and again from September 2017 to October 2018.
That constant 1-2 ranking felt like forever.
They played every French Open and Wimbledon final from 2006 to 2008, with their 2008 Wimbledon final widely lauded, as we mentioned, as potentially the greatest match ever played. Their last encounter was at Wimbledon in 2019, with Federer winning to reach the final, a final poignant victory.
Then there's the equally intense, sometimes more fiercely contested, rivalry with Novak Djokovic, which saw them play 50 times, with Djokovic leading 27-23.
50 matches? That's incredible volume.
It's actually the second most prolific major rivalry, with 17 meetings at Grand Slams. While tied on clay, Djokovic leads on hard courts 20-18 and grass 3-1.
Djokovic really had his number on the big stages later on.
Federer notably ended Djokovic's incredible 41-0 start to the 2011 season in the French Open semifinals, a huge moment of disruption. However, Djokovic famously saved match points against Federer in the U.S. Open semifinals in 2010 and 2011, showcasing his own clutch play.
Those U.S. Open semis were brutal.
And most heartbreakingly for Federer fans, Djokovic won all three Wimbledon finals they contested in 2014, 2015, and 2019, even saving 2 championship points in that epic 2019 final. These matches weren't just contests. They were narratives of will and skill, creating some of the most compelling drama in sports history.
And we can't forget Andy Murray, another significant rival who contributed to this golden age. They played 25 times, with Federer leading 14-11, predominantly on hardened grass courts.
Murray always pushed him.
Federer won their first 3 major finals at the 2008 U.S. Open, 2010 Australian Open, and 2012 Wimbledon, establishing an early dominance in major final matchups. However, Murray famously denied Federer a career Golden Slam by winning the 2012 Olympic final on center court, a highly emotional victory for the Briton.
That Olympic final was huge for Murray.
While Andy Roddick famously called his head-to-head with Federer not much of a rivalry due to Federer's dominant 21-3 lead.
Yeah, Roddick was pretty blunt about that.
Those 4 Grand Slam finals they played, all won by Federer, were still memorable clashes, characterized by Roddick's powerful serve against Federer's all-court artistry.
Mm.
Beyond these main rivalries, Federer's dominance extended to many other top-tier players of his era.
Ray Hewitt, Safin.
As he consistently held strong head-to-head records against multiple Grand Slam champions and top 10 players like Leighton Hewitt, Murat Safin, Juan Martín del Potro, and Joe Wilfred Tsonga, showcasing his incredible versatility and consistent ability to overcome generational talent.
So when you start to tally up the numbers, it's not just the big Grand Slam titles that tell the story. It's the sheer breadth and depth of his records across every category.
Cool.
It truly paints a picture of a player who didn't just win a lot, but he set completely new standards for excellence and consistency that fundamentally reshaped the sport. Speaking of numbers, Federer's list of unparalleled records and accolades is simply astounding.
It really is. The list goes on and on.
He won 20 Grand Slam singles titles, placing him third all-time, a monumental achievement. But what's truly insightful about Federer's record isn't just the sheer number of wins, but the unprecedented consistency they represent. Consider this. He reached 31 major finals, the second most after Djokovic, including a record 10 consecutive Grand Slam finals.
10 consecutive finals. That's insane consistency.
A mental and physical feat that speaks volumes about his sustained focus at the absolute pinnacle of the sport. He also holds a record 8 Wimbledon titles, including a joint record 5 in a row, and a joint record 5 U.S. Open titles, also a record 5 in a row. These are markers of pure, sustained supremacy on the biggest stages.
And his time at the very top of the rankings is equally, if not more, impressive and a testament to his consistency. He held the world number one spot for an incredible 310 weeks, the second longest amount of time for a male player, including a then-record 237 consecutive weeks.
That consecutive weeks record might never be broken.
This means he didn't just reach the top. He stayed there week after week, for years on end, facing constant challenges. He was ranked among the top 8 players in the world continuously for a mind-boggling 14 years and 2 weeks.
14 years in the top 8.
His mantelpiece of awards goes far beyond just on-court performance, reflecting his character and popularity. He was named ATP Player of the Year 5 times and ITF World Champion 5 times. Mm. He was voted by his peers to receive the Tour Sportsmanship Award an astonishing record 13 times.
13 times. Shows the respect he had.
And by fans to receive the ATP Fans Favorite Award for an incredible 19 consecutive years, demonstrating his immense respect and unparalleled popularity across the globe.
19 years as fan favorite, wow.
He also won the Arthur Ashe Humanitarian of the Year Award twice and the Laureus World Sportsman of the Year Award a record 5 times, including the Laureus World Comeback of the Year after his miraculous 2017 season. This wasn't just about winning. It was about how he won and how he carried himself.
Beyond those major awards, the specific records are just mind-boggling and illustrate his unique mastery across different aspects of the game. The sources list him as holding 30 Guinness World Records, 18 of which are performance-based.
Guinness records, too. He's everywhere.
It's not just a large number. These are records that highlight his singular position in tennis history. For example, he holds the unique open-era record of 2 consecutive seasons with 3 singles titles. He achieved 5 consecutive titles in 2 different tournaments, Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, a feat that requires both adaptability and sustained focus on different surfaces.
5 in a row at 2 different slams.
Perhaps even more impressively, he holds records for sustained performance at Grand Slams, reaching 10 consecutive singles finals appearances, an almost unbelievable 23 consecutive semifinals, and 36 consecutive quarterfinals.
Those streaks, quarters, semis, finals are just unreal.
These aren't just numbers. They represent an iron will and an unparalleled capacity for consistent excellence under the highest pressure. He has also won 102 or more matches at 2 different majors and boasts 65 consecutive grass court match victories.
65 straight on grass.
It's not just a few dominant years. It's 2 decades of statistical excellence across almost every conceivable metric, a benchmark for future generations.
What's truly fascinating here is how his impact extends far beyond the boundaries of the tennis court, transcending sports to become a cultural and philanthropic force.
Yeah, he became more than just a tennis player.
From revitalizing the sport economically to his extensive philanthropic work, and even becoming a global cultural icon, Federer truly became a global phenomenon. Many in the tennis world, including legends like Rod Laver, Bjorn Borg, and even Pete Sampras, though Sampras later shifted his opinion to Djokovic, have hailed him as the greatest tennis player of all time.
High praise from the legends themselves.
Serena Williams, another titan of the sport, simply described him as a genius. And Richard Gasquet famously stated in 2021 that aesthetics and grace are, to him, more important than the raw number of Grand Slam titles in deciding who is the greatest, pointedly singling out Federer for his aesthetics, the grace he has on the court.
That Gasquet quote about aesthetics is really interesting.
This highlights a qualitative aspect of his greatness that often goes beyond mere statistics.
His influence clearly transcended pure numbers, a truly rare quality for any athlete. Federer is widely credited with leading a golden age revival in tennis, which dramatically increased interest in the sport globally and led to an explosion in prize money and revenues.
He absolutely boosted the sport's profile.
To illustrate, when he first won the Australian Open in 2004, he earned $985,000. By his win in 2018, the prize had soared to AUD 4 million, reflecting the sport's economic boom, largely spurred by his charisma and the rivalries he fostered.
That's a massive jump in prize money.
He's also been a deeply committed philanthropist. He established the Roger Federer Foundation in 2003 to help disadvantaged children in Southern Africa access education and sport, a cause close to his heart due to his mother's heritage.
His foundation does incredible work.
He's supported the South Africa-Swiss charity MBWU, became a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, and organized numerous high-profile charity events like Rally for Relief, Hit for Haiti, and the Match for Africa series, famously partnering with Bill Gates in one instance.
The Match for Africa events were always fun.
Where Federer even won a point on his knees after returning two shots while on the ground, a moment that beautifully encapsulated his combination of skill and showmanship, all for a good cause.
His off-court commercial success is equally unprecedented, making him a true marketing powerhouse. He was routinely one of the top 10 highest-paid athletes in the world, earning an estimated $100 million in endorsement income in 2020 alone.
$100 million in endorsements in 1 year.
In August 2023, Forbes estimated his net worth at an astounding $1.1 billion, making him the seventh billionaire athlete in history, largely boosted by his shrewd minority stake in the Swiss shoe and apparel brand On.
The On investment was clearly huge for him.
He has been endorsed by a who's who of global luxury and consumer brands, including Uniqlo, after his long association with Nike, On, Rolex, Lindt, Sunrise, Jura, Mercedes-Benz, Gillette, Barilla, and Moët & Chandon.
Quite the portfolio.
His public image is immensely positive, earning him universally popular nicknames like FedEx, Swiss Maestro, King Roger, and the Swiss Perfection. Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world twice in 2007 and 2010.
Time 100 twice.
A 2011 Reputation Institute study even ranked him globally second only to Nelson Mandela in terms of public reputation. And in a nod to his broader cultural impact, he was named GQ's most stylish man of the decade from 2010 to 2019.
Second only to Mandela. That's incredible. And most stylish, too. Huh. His impact is literally enshrined in the physical world and academic institutions. The city of Halle, Germany, where he won many titles, has a Roger Federer Alley dedicated to him. In 2016, Beal renamed a street One Alley Roger Federer, located where the Swiss National Tennis Center is.
Street's named after him. Nice.
His hometown of Basel launched a tram named the Federer Express in 2021, a delightful nod to his speed and impact. He received honorary doctorates from the University of Basel in 2017 and Dartmouth in 2024, recognizing his contributions beyond sport.
Dr. Federer.
And in a truly unique national honor, he became the first living person to be celebrated on Swiss coins in 2019, with his face appearing on the 20-franc coin. He was even featured by the prestigious Swiss National Museum in a chronicle of Swiss history and culture. He is, without exaggeration, truly a cultural icon, a living part of Switzerland's national identity.
Beyond the dazzling public persona, the relentless pursuit of perfection on court, and his immense global impact, we also gain insight into a remarkably grounded private life, a meticulous approach to his health and training, and a deep personal connection to his family and heritage.
Yeah, let's touch on the personal side.
He married former WTA player Mirka Vavrinec, whom he famously met at the 2000 Sydney Olympics. Mirka retired early from her own career due to a foot injury, but her dedication to training profoundly influenced Federer's early work ethic. She famously trained 6 hours a day while he would lose interest within an hour, providing him with a powerful example.
Mirka's influence seems really important, especially early on.
They married in 2009 and have four children, identical twin girls born in 2009 and fraternal twin boys born in 2014, making for a wonderfully busy household.
Two sets of twins. Amazing.
He primarily resides in Valbella, Switzerland, but also owns an apartment in Dubai for training in hot weather and a penthouse in Zurich, balancing his professional needs with his personal life.
That deep personal connection to family clearly helped ground him amidst global fame and the relentless pressure of professional tennis. His health, as the sources clearly delineate, has also been a significant and often challenging factor throughout his career.
Yeah, the body takes a beating.
He was discharged from compulsory military service in 1999 due to a chronic back problem, a condition that would flare up at times. Notably, he only ever conceded 3 singles walkovers in his entire professional career, all due to back injuries, a testament to his incredible resilience and determination to always finish a match.
Only 3 walkovers ever. That's dedication.
In 2008, he revealed he'd suffered from mononucleosis, which subtly but significantly impacted his fitness and performance during that challenging year. Later in his career, he underwent 3 major knee surgeries. 2 on his left knee in 2016 and 2020, and a 3rd on his right knee in 2022.
Those knee surgeries really took their toll at the end.
The discussions around meniscus surgery and its long-term implications, like eventual pain and potential arthritis, truly highlight the immense physical toll his career took on his body, a silent struggle behind the grace.
Yet despite these significant physical challenges, he maintained a remarkably meticulous and multifaceted training program targeting every muscle, incorporating everything from medicine ball throws to precise racket drills and specialized conditioning.
Always working, always refining.
He's also a highly skilled multilingual individual with Swiss Standard German as his native language, fluent German, French, and English, and functional Italian and some Swedish. This linguistic ability allowed him to connect with fans, media, and fellow players worldwide on a deeply personal level.
Being multilingual is such an asset on a global tour.
He was raised Roman Catholic and even met Pope Benedict XVI in 2006, reflecting another aspect of his personal life. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Beyond the dazzling public persona, the relentless pursuit of perfection, and his immense global impact, we see a private life that grounds him, a meticulous and intelligent approach to his health and training, and a deep personal connection to his family and heritage.
Yeah.
It's a holistic and deeply human picture of a champion who balanced extraordinary public life with a grounded personal existence.
From a passionate, sometimes temperamental junior to the universally adored Swiss maestro, Roger Federer's story, as our deep dives has revealed, is one of constant evolution, both as an athlete and a person. He didn't just conquer the game, he elevated it to an art form, inspiring millions.
Indeed. His journey encourages us to consider how much of legendary status is pure, raw talent versus relentless self-improvement, intelligent adaptation, and the profound ability to inspire. He leaves us with a truly profound understanding of what it means to transcend a sport, to become an icon that resonates far beyond the boundaries of competition.
And that raises an important question for you to consider. In a world increasingly focused on raw numbers, statistics, and Grand Slam counts, does Federer's widely acknowledged grace, aesthetics, and fluid artistry on court, as highlighted by Richard Gasquet and countless others, offer a more enduring and perhaps even more significant measure of greatness than merely the final tally of his major titles?
Interesting question to ponder.
Think about what truly defines a legend.